This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the middle of October, and this week there was not a presidential debate. There was supposed to be a town hall format debate, but uncertainty over the president's medical condition led the Commission on Presidential Debates to declare the town hall would have to be virtual, with the candidates in remote locations. Trump refused, and so each candidate held a separate town hall on Thursday evening. Trump, eventually demonstrating to NBC's satisfaction that he was no longer contagious, was in person on a windy outdoor Miami set with Savannah Guthrie. And the president again sought to defend his COVID record, saying if he hadn't acted, we might have had more than 2 million deaths in the United States. Now, as Guthrie pointed out, that was the estimate if we as a country did nothing at all to stop infections. Biden's town hall, indoors in Pittsburgh with George Stephanopoulos, was a more sedate affair. Biden touted, for example, the promise of cheap battery technology to make renewable energy more widespread. Another thing Trump said was that he wants another round of economic relief for coronavirus, but that continues to be a matter on which his position swings back and forth. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi have gotten closer on terms for a deal, but Senate Republicans have shown little interest in those terms, and the president is showing little interest in changing their mind. Now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by a new panel this week. Through the election, we will have Tim Carney on the right. He's a columnist at the Washington Examiner and resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And on the left will be Christine Emba, columnist at the Washington Post. Hello.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, good to talk to you again.
Good to have both of you back. So, Tim, the president is trailing in the polls. I found it puzzling that he chose to sit out this debate, since he's the one who needs to change voters' minds and change the race if he intends to win it. Did he make an argument for his own reelection on Thursday?
What he did was he showed the same exact thing that helped get him the Republican nomination and to some extent probably helped get him the election 4 years ago, which is that he's there to fight. I mean, that was the feistiest town hall we've ever seen. And his campaign even called it a debate between him and Savannah Guthrie. And so arguing, fighting back, even whether he had the facts on his side or not, was exactly the sort of thing that helped get him elected. So did he make a case? Not the sort of case that's going to convince you, not the sort of case that's going to convince me, but for people looking for a fighter, maybe he did. I don't think he moved it nearly enough to make up the deficit he has, but he showed that he's fighting Donald Trump.
Christine, what did you learn from the town hall?
Well, I thought that Tim's use of the word feisty makes a lot of sense because it calls to mind what Savannah Guthrie said during the debate, which I think encapsulated it perfectly. She chastised Trump at one point for spreading conspiracy theories via his Twitter retweets, saying that he shouldn't do that because, you know, it's not like he's someone's crazy uncle or something. Alas, it seems like he is everybody's crazy uncle. Nobody wants to sit next to him at Thanksgiving. In fact, frankly, this debate, or rather this non-debate town hall, made the case for why he shouldn't be there. He actually works best in debate formats, because in those cases, when he's not asked enough one-on-one questions, he can use his patented method of sort of lying, bluster, and changing the subject to get away from answering real questions. But this time, one-on-one with an interviewer who actually did press points with a smile, Savannah Guthrie made Trump look bad. Or rather, she helped him make himself look bad, because it became apparent that he couldn't answer many of her questions, refused to answer others, and that most of his responses were wildly inadequate. Polls show right now that the more people see of Donald Trump, the less they like him. This town hall featuring everybody's horrible, weird old uncle, again, made the case that we would like to see less of him.
Tim, one of the big outstanding policy issues facing Washington for the next few weeks before the election is this question of whether there will be another relief package for coronavirus. And it's been a question that's been with us since July, when many key parts of the last relief package ran out. And it's clear to me that Senate Republicans, they really want to make confirming Amy Coney Barrett their number one priority. And it looks like they're preparing to lose this election. They're preparing to lose control of Congress. They're preparing to lose the presidency. And they expect the court to be there to be the check on the Democratic control that they seem to be admitting we're about to have in Washington. Senator Ben Sasse even returned to quite openly criticizing the president, saying on a teletown hall that his handling of coronavirus has not been defensible or acceptable. And so I guess my question is, first of all, do you agree with that assessment that Republicans have been admitting here that they're going to lose? And why is the president going in on that? It would seem that, you know, even if the Republican Party has a strategy for how they're going to protect their policy prerogatives, even if they lose this election, I would be expecting him to be pushing hard for Republicans in Congress to deliver for him this policy deliverable that might actually help him at the margin if he's trying to win the election.
I think you're mostly right, Josh. I don't think the right way to see it is a 6-3 Republican-appointed court is a check on a Democratic majority. I think that's an overly cynical interpretation. What I would say is the 6-3 Republican-appointed majority is the point. This is what Republicans are spending their election victories on. Just like Nancy Pelosi in 2010 spent her majority, was willing to give it away to get Obamacare, that was the purpose of being the majority. The purpose for so many conservatives is to get a majority on the court. You're going to have a chance to overturn Roe v. Wade, and you're not going to have the court advancing sort of the liberal culture war stuff that only a liberal majority or a liberal moderate majority on the court can do. And I would say, as far as why is Trump going along, I don't think Trump has big political strategies. I mean, Mitch McConnell and the Republican House leadership back when they had the majority kind of found a way to come up with a plan that they would give to Trump and he would carry the ball, go along with it, be a cheerleader for it. That's how they got the tax cuts, was all of them working together. At this point, the interests of Mitch McConnell is to do what he's always been trying to do, get more conservative judges. They do not at this point anymore coincide with the interests of Donald Trump. And so the interests of Donald Trump are kind of getting shucked aside by the Republican Senate.
Christine, I think something that has happened over the course of the last few months of this election that has surprised a lot of observers is that it's not just that Biden has maintained or maybe slightly increased the lead that he has in the national polls. His favorable numbers have been improving and are significantly above water now. Significantly more people have a favorable view of Joe Biden than an unfavorable view. And there had been this expectation that in this time of negative partisanship, where politicians in general have been getting lower ratings in polls than they used to a few decades ago, that as Joe Biden became defined as the Democratic opponent, that his favorable numbers would go down. That hasn't happened. I'm wondering what you make of that. I mean, part of what we're seeing here, I think, is that people who had an unfavorable view of Biden because they preferred a farther left candidate in the Democratic primary, they've come home. And I'm wondering why that would be the case. Did you, for example, did you see anything in Joe Biden's town hall this week that made you feel more positively, not just about the idea that he wasn't Donald Trump, but about him unto himself as the Democratic candidate?
So I think that's actually kind of a couple of separate but related questions. So I think that one of the things that Biden showed in this town hall and, you know, continues to talk about on the stump is that even if he is elected, you know, as a representative of the Democratic Party, he plans to govern for all Americans. You know, he says he wants to be the president of all Americans. He repeats this, you know, basically in every speech and every appearance that he makes. So I think, you know, you could actually make the argument that when he was seen as extremely, like, very closely tied to a far left Democratic establishment, people who didn't like a far left Democratic establishment, you know, didn't like Joe Biden. But now he almost seems to be broadening himself away from the party. He identifies as a Democrat, but he's really for everybody. He's friendly to everybody. He just wants to help unite us. And I think that Joe Biden is one that a lot of people, you know, appreciate. I think everybody knows that negative partisanship is a thing, you know, has experienced, you know, these wild political debates over the past 4 years, and they're kind of tired of it. They want somebody who is, if not neutral, at least calming. You know, in the town hall, it was actually, I think, really pleasant for a lot of people to be able to flip away from Donald Trump's sort of yelping and blustering to just hear, like, Joe Biden, a generally neutral, not extreme, nice guy, sort of droning gently about complicated policy plans. The more that Joe Biden just seems like a nice, decent person who wants to represent all of America, and yes, continues to be defined against Trump, not necessarily as the representative of the Democrats writ large, I think the better he's going to do. And I think that's what we're seeing.
Tim, does that reassure you at all?
No, I mean, what I see is a severe failure of our democratic process because of Donald Trump and the liberal news media. Joe Biden has not had effective criticism of him since Bernie Sanders dropped out of the race, and even Sanders wasn't much of an attack dog on him. since clearing the field and winning the Democratic primary, there hasn't been an effective criticism of him, because the Trump campaign can only come up with things like he's really secretly Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and is pro-riot and that sort of thing, which does not ring true. The mainstream media is not interested in challenging him. To the extent that they challenged Hillary Clinton 4 years ago, they got harangued for 4 years by the Democratic establishment for pointing out her dishonesty, her violation of presidential records acts, etc. And so the media is throwing softballs. And the George Stephanopoulos town hall compared to the Savannah Guthrie town hall was a great example. It wasn't just a difference in persona of the two. Joe Biden, far from being sleepy, is one of the feistiest politicians I've seen. If you remember the way he debated Paul Ryan 8 years ago, he can go blow for blow if somebody challenges him. The press generally isn't interested in challenging him on things such as his new extreme position on abortion, on the foreign policy failures of the Obama administration, on the inconsistencies between what he says he's doing on taxes and what his actual tax policy implies. There's no effective critique of him, and that's why he's rising in the polls.
I want to talk about one of the themes that we've seen both at the Trump town hall last week and at the presidential debate 2 weeks prior to that, which is the relative failure of the U.S. in terms of containing coronavirus compared to other rich countries. One statistic from the vice presidential debate was that our death rate has been about 2.5 times higher than in Canada. We've generally had worse performance than countries in Western Europe. But it's important to note that things have gotten really ugly in Europe over the last few weeks. And Christine, I know you're actually in the Netherlands right now. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're seeing on the ground there? And I think a lot of Americans, especially on the left, have this idea that sort of Europe gets all these things right and they have a good technocratic government that is handling all these things in a way that we can't hear. What is the actual situation on the ground there?
I'm sorry to disappoint, I guess, all of those people who want to hear me hate on Europe, but it does seem like they have a good technocratic government and they're getting things right on the ground. Yes, cases are rising in Europe more quickly than they were in the summer. The theory is that it's in part because people, you know, once cases did drop, went traveling around Europe in the summer and are now back from vacation and are also back in their workplaces. One of the first things that I noticed when I arrived in the Netherlands, actually, was just the sort of palpable degree of difference you felt almost in the atmosphere, that, you know, there was this understanding that coronavirus, A, is real and harmful, and B, that the government was putting regulations in place that were meant to protect citizens and help them live their lives. And for the common good, people were expected to put up with some changes in their daily lives and abide by rules and regulations to make things safer. And by and large, people just did that without complaining too much. There was contact tracing put into place. Every, you know, coffee shop or restaurant that you went into, you had to scan an app or simply write down your name and contact information so that you could be reached out to in the case of a coronavirus outbreak that had stemmed from that place. You were asked to get tested as quickly as possible if you experienced signs or symptoms. And testing was really easy. I went to a bike-through testing center my third day upon arrival, in which I literally just rode a bike up to a building, walked my bike through the building, got a test and left, and they called me the next day. In the US, you hear these stories of people who think that contact tracing is somehow just a way for the government to collect your information, and that's scary and they don't want to do it. You know, that tests are, who knows what people think the tests are, but also in general, this summer you weren't getting results back for 5 or more days, which renders a test fairly ineffective. There's also, you know, a mask mandate. Whenever you're on public transit or in populated places, you are expected to wear a mask and you will get a fine and be chewed out by an official if you don't. And by and large, people do this without complaining. You know, they don't punch police officers or fight with store owners who ask you to wear a mask. They just do it because it's expected that you're supposed to care for other people. It's responsible. And also the government has asked you to do this. And like, there's a general trust that they know what they're doing because they work with scientists.
If that's working so much better over there, why are they back to having more new cases per day on a per capita basis than we have?
So I'll also note that at least in Amsterdam, where I am, cases fell to the point that people had gone back to their offices for, if not the most part, at least several days a week. You could, in fact, still eat in restaurants, go out without a mask. Mask wearing was mandated in certain spaces, but not all. And yes, people began traveling again to a far greater extent than they had in the United States. So I think this combination of, yes, just people being out and about and slightly less careful in the summer did lead to cases rising. But now that cases have risen, the government has put into place restaurant curfews, bar curfews, has asked people to start working from home again. And by and large, everyone has accepted that. It's disappointing, but they want to keep the cases from rising further.
Tim, one thing the president was asked about on Thursday was this Great Barrington Declaration, which is basically a statement from a set of scientists saying that, you know, that more or less herd immunity is the best approach to dealing with coronavirus, that you should try to protect the most vulnerable people in the population, isolate them, and then tell other people to go back about their lives. Now, the problem with that is if you do that, you're going to have a lot more cases, a lot more cases. And then the hopes that some people had had about herd immunity, I think, are being undermined by these new waves that we're seeing in certain places. Belgium, which was probably the hardest hit country in Europe the first time around, is being hit extremely hard again. Doesn't seem to have been protected by herd immunity. Here in the United States, in New York, we have been seeing new outbreaks in Orthodox Jewish communities that in New York that had very high rates of cases the first time around. And so it seems to me that the president couldn't quite defend this on Thursday. It just seems very out of touch with public opinion and also with, as the administration keeps touting, we're likely a few months away from significant distribution of a vaccine that could protect a lot of people from ever getting coronavirus. So what is with the effort to sort of get people to throw in the towel now and just accept a new large wave of coronavirus cases?
Well, we were promised, remember, 15 days to stop the spread, and we were told to flatten the curve. The parts of the country that flattened the curve, that is, put off any big surges until the summer, were chastised endlessly by you know, the New York Times and the big media for not having the giant spike that that Cuomo and de Blasio's New York did. And so the ever-shifting explanation of what we have, and then some public health experts and your teachers' unions. For so many parents, a big thing is, let's get our kids back to school. And the teachers' union saying, no, no matter what. You've got, when you had approximately 1% positivity in New York City, the teachers' unions were threatening to go on strike if they opened. And that's exactly what we would expect to happen in the D.C. area, where we, for the most part, have been under 3%. We don't think they're going to let us send our kids back to public school. So the idea that there's there's no achievable victory. It reminds me of like the war on terrorism under Bush. We have to keep these rules in place until we've wiped it out. That seems unachievable. So people turn to something that is unsound, in my opinion, and in the opinion of most of the scientists I've read from, of herd immunity. But the problem is that the articulating a win, especially when they say, oh, no, when we have a vaccine, most people won't be able to get it. People want to win this. And if it's not winnable, then they want to start just living with it.
Well, but I have a couple of objections to that. One is, you know, the idea of we were promised. Like, we've all been feeling our way through this. As we were making policy decisions in February and March, we couldn't know what the course of this was going to be. So it's not like our policymakers got to make binding promises in March, and because new information came to light, that means that we somehow have to honor that, even if the claim that we could stop this in 15 days, which I think was never plausible, that we have to hold to that is just wrong. And then the other thing is that we do have an alternative plan here, which is to say that there are therapeutic drugs, including some that the president was put on, that have significant promise that may be more widely available soon, but are not now. And we may well have a vaccine that is approved before the end of the year and in wide distributions in the first part of next year. So that is the light at the end of the tunnel. So I don't, the idea that, you know, we need to just go out and live with it. And then the third thing is that we are living with it. We're not under the lockdowns that we were under in March and April. And so the restrictions on activity, and I agree, we'll talk later in the show about schools, and I think that there is room to do different things there. Around around schools and certain other things. But in general, we have made a lot of those moves back toward people being able to live more normal lives, do most of the things that they normally do, with a view toward a few months from now being able to do even more than that. So that's what I just find so puzzling about this idea that now is the time we need to give up, when I think the one thing the president has been right about in his optimism is that the pharmaceutical stuff is going pretty well and is going to be very useful to us not very far in the future.
Well, and Trump tries to say that, but he can't say it clearly, and he can't help but switch into something else that's a little more crackpot. What you articulated is what he talks about. He calls it cures instead of therapeutics, and he does try to articulate that. And it is really one of the dangers of having a president who can't speak or think clearly, is that at times he tries to say exactly what you just said, but then he shifts into the herd immunity, which, again, to be very clear, is not a good strategy in our country to try to fight coronavirus.
Josh, as you were saying, I mean, there is a wide area between, you know, locking down completely, never seeing another human being, and just giving up and not doing anything and just hoping that coronavirus goes away, since we didn't meet our promised 15 days back in the spring. As I'm seeing in Europe, you can, you know, wear masks, you can not go to bars late at night, you can give up certain things to make sure that yourself and others are at least slightly more safe than you would have been otherwise. It sucks sometimes, but as a society, you can agree to care for others and yourselves. It doesn't seem that hard to do, and I'm not so sure why conservatives seem so opposed to that.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will talk about the Amy Coney Barrett hearing, and for some reason, we will also talk about Twitter. I've been talking with Christine Emba of The Washington Post and Tim Carney of The Washington Examiner. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Tim Carney, columnist at The Washington Examiner. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. Tim, let's talk about Twitter, and I do think this is an important news story this week, but there was this story in the New York Post about these emails of very strange provenance that are purported, at least, to be from Hunter Biden regarding his business work in Ukraine and in China, and social media giants Twitter and Facebook reacted to the spread of this story in a way that drew significant backlash, including, but not entirely, from the right.
Yeah, when you consider that as of the latest information I have while I'm speaking, the Biden campaign officially denied having a scheduled meeting with this Burisma official, which was never, in fact, alleged. The idea that Hunter introduced a Burisma colleague to the vice president, his father, which was the core of the story, has never been denied as of now by Hunter or Joe Biden. And so what it looks like to us is that a story with reporting critical of Joe Biden was shut down because it was a story with reporting critical of Joe Biden. All the justifications offered, oh, well, this was hacked information. This was, I mean, come on, we just spent a week talking about Donald Trump's taxes, which were almost certainly not passed along with Donald Trump's authority. And whistleblowers are constantly releasing information. Twitter, in fact, ended up walking away from that one. The idea that it wasn't thoroughly sourced, come on. So much of our news goes out there not thoroughly sourced. There are factual errors that are never corrected by, you know, CNN, MSNBC, everybody. Probably you and me, Christine and Josh. There are errors out there that get to be on Twitter and float around. So to say, oh, well, this wasn't properly sourced. The excuses they gave to defend blocking access from Twitter to this New York Post story all rang hollow, because it was really about a story that people didn't like, that was about Joe Biden, and they didn't like the sourcing and they didn't like the conclusion, and Twitter blocked it. And I think they ended up realizing it was a mistake. It was a panic because a bunch of angry liberals on Twitter started haranguing them because they felt like they were going through the same thing they went through 4 years ago when Hillary Clinton's email server became a big story.
Christine, were you creeped out at all by Twitter basically saying that, you know, this link to this particular story on a major newspaper, you couldn't share it on Twitter, they would lock down people's accounts for posting the story?
I wouldn't say that I was creeped out. I thought that it was a little bit excessive, maybe a lot excessive, in fact. But I also did understand where they were coming from. I actually don't, Contra Tim, think that this was because Twitter is secretly in, you know, the Joe Biden fandom and doesn't want any negative information about Joe Biden to be spread. We've seen Twitter especially trying to figure out what they're going to do about disinformation in the upcoming election, which I think they think for good reason could become contentious and, you know, maybe even potentially dangerous. They've been sort of wargaming these strategies about, you know, what if there is a hack and leak situation of unverified emails like, you know, in 2016 that causes, you know, widespread misinformation and somehow swings the election, especially if it comes from a source, say, a foreign government or, you know, some other sort of nefarious person or persons who wish to influence the election. I think that's what they thought they saw happening here. There have been reports that Rudy Giuliani has been a feeder for this misinformation before. And Tim, I mean, you have to admit that a random computer repair guy who is, I don't know, on a different coast than Hunter Biden gets these emails, but before turning them into the FBI, copies the server and sends it to Rudy Giuliani, who then sits on this information and leaks it in the days before the election. Like, that is a little bit weird. It's pretty weird. And Twitter has been trying to figure out what they would do in these situations. They leapt into their first strategy, which was just to lock everything down. As you said, they quickly realized that that was a bit over the top and pulled back. But of course, not before I think the right decided to make it into a case of censoring information about Joe Biden, not trying to hold off crazy conspiracies from Rudy Giuliani, which is what they were really doing.
But it was literally a case of censoring.
Yeah, they didn't just flag it. They said you can't access this story from our platform.
Yes, they did. Absolutely. And Twitter is a private platform and they are allowed to do that. Whether it was a good decision or not is another question. I would agree with you that it was a poor decision, but that is something they're allowed to do.
And this rule that somehow if it comes from a foreign government, if it's hacked emails, all of that is just sort of trying to relitigate 2016, where they think Russia stole the election. These rules are not real rules. And we know that because, again, the odds that Donald Trump's taxes were an authorized disclosure are approximately zero. And so, but that was good reporting. I am glad we got Donald Trump's taxes. And if Joe Biden was wrong about Hunter never introducing him or trying to play his contacts to help Burisma, well, that's not the biggest scandal in the world if it was just a handshake. But you know what? It matters. It reflects on him. And that would be good sort of journalism. Now, if it comes from sketchy Russian people, yeah, we really ought to have a discussion about that. But the way to have that discussion is not to censor access to it. And as every liberal noted by Friday morning, you know what? They made that a much bigger story by trying to shut it down than they would have if they had just let people click on that New York Post link.
I would agree with you on that. They really Streisand affected this story. That said, I do think that you made an interesting point about, you know, important and, you know, verifiable reporting that we need to have. And while you may say that Trump's tax returns were leaked to the New York Times, I think what you're also saying is that you can sort of trust the New York Times in their reporting that they, you know, found a source for these that tax returns that was credible and presented it well. I don't know if you can say the same thing about this mysterious email leak from Giuliani and company. And I think that difference does matter.
And I don't trust Twitter to adjudicate that.
Fair enough.
Tim, a lot of conservatives have been talking about this as a reason that we need more regulation of social media giants. Ted Cruz said that they're going to subpoena Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey to come testify before Congress. This is fuel for the ongoing effort by many conservatives to revisit what's called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996, which protects platforms like Twitter from liability when their users post things on the site that may be illegal, saying that, you know, if you want that protection, then you need to follow follow certain rules, certain very undefined rules about how you moderate that content, because conservatives feel that the moderation goes unfairly against them. And it seems to me, watching this episode, that this is actually an argument against the idea that we need that sort of regulation. And Senator Josh Hawley said that, you know, Facebook is not like a supermarket, because it's like if there was only one supermarket you could go to and they had a total monopoly. Hawley made this comment on Twitter. And what we saw is that whatever bad decision that Twitter made here, it didn't stop people from learning about this story. There are lots of other social media platforms and other ways that people disseminate information. And then ultimately, Twitter responded to the reaction in the market, in the community, and said that they had made a mistake and they were going to do something different. So doesn't this actually undermine the idea that the government needs to put its hands in here more and govern how entities like Twitter operate?
I think in this case it does, but you are really highlighting a huge difference on the right. The more nationalistic parts of the conservative movement and the more libertarian parts really could not be more at odds on any issue than regulating big tech. I sometimes find myself in the middle saying, well, you know, if Twitter almost has something of a monopoly, the more subtle things they might do might be more problematic. And so But I'm more afraid of the Kamala Harris administration telling tech companies which cakes they have to bake and which ones they don't, so to speak, than I am of, Twitter reacting to a Kyle Griffin tweet and panicking for 24 hours. But you're exactly right that among a lot of conservatives, big tech is a pernicious effect. This isn't the best example, though. It's the little thing. So what might get there's always a worry about shadow ban. On Google, we know as conservative writers, it constantly seems that we're getting buried. Maybe that's just our imagination or not. The more subtle ways that these big platforms can discriminate is more worrisome to me than this episode. But in general, I feel that urge. These guys have to be reined in. But then I remember, if government is telling these guys how to run their business, in the long run, that's not going to accrue to the benefit of conservatives.
Christine, this is also an area where I think the left is cross-pressured. There are a lot of things that people on the left have been upset with how the social media giants have behaved over the last few years, including about the spread of disinformation and various such things. But if you try to use the government to fix that, you then end up in a situation where maybe somebody that's Josh Hawley's pick ends up running that regulation. So are you eager for the government to have more of a hand in how these platforms operate?
You know, I wouldn't say that I'm eager for the government per se to have a hand in how these platforms operate. I think certain regulators might be better at this than others, and certain governments might be perhaps less biased than others. That said, I think it's almost less a problem of regulating what exactly the social media companies get up to in their time than, you know, simply the size and the power of these companies. They are too large. They do have a platform monopoly, and they are growing and growing and having more influence. If anything, what the government should be pushing to do is simply, you know, break them apart in some way and make them a bit smaller so that they don't have this much power. And honestly, any administration could work on that.
Let's talk some about the hearings for Amy Coney Barrett and her nomination to the Supreme Court. I always struggle a little bit with how to cover these hearings because the hearings are sort of intentionally low on content. The nominee declines to make specific comments about specific cases that might come before them for the good reason that you don't want to judge a case before it's actually argued, and for the less good reason that shields the nominee from making politically sensitive disclosures. But so, Christine, let's start with you. What did we learn this week at these hearings?
I mean, not very much. Again, we learned that both sides seem to be taking this as a given, that Republicans have the vote, and so they will confirm their nominee, whether that means they are hypocrites compared to how they dealt with Merrick Garland several years ago, or whether, in fact, the nominee is actually any good or not. Although I will say that it does seem like Amy Coney Barrett is a very smart woman and an accomplished jurist. But just as you say, Josh, it kind of doesn't matter. Everyone took an opportunity to grandstand and or to make jokes about how many children Barrett has, but in the end, it's not going to change anything.
Tim, how about you? Did you learn anything?
I learned that often it brings out the worst in our commentariat. You did have articles and tweets that were pretty bad. I tried to not be one of those people making bad tweets because we do feel so much is at stake. And it's really a shame that so much is at stake in these nominations and confirmations, because the court shouldn't have that much power over our life. I also learned that a lot of people have no idea what the word originalist means. Dan Rather and members of Congress and other people claiming that if you're originalist, the amendments to the Constitution don't count and you probably shouldn't even cook with gas or electric, as Dan Rather put it. But we don't need the average people. They shouldn't have to be educated in jurisprudence. The courts should be more boring and have less of an impact on our life.
One thing that struck me this week was that it wasn't just Barrett herself trying to avoid taking an explicit position on Roe versus Wade. You had a lot of Republican commentators, up to and including the president, demurring on the idea that a court with Barrett on it might overturn Roe v. Wade. And the president said that, you know, he said at the debate a couple of weeks ago that he doesn't think Roe is on the ballot at the court. He is unclear on the idea that the court might actually overturn Roe with three of his appointees on it. And yet in the 2016 campaign, he said he would appoint judges who would overturn Roe. So what is with conservative lawmakers not just going out there and saying explicitly, we want Roe overturned and we really hope that this court with our nominees on it will do that?
Well, when you actually poll people and just ask them, do you like Roe v. Wade? Should it be overturned? They like it and they say it shouldn't be overturned. The actual substance of it, I argue, and we conducted a poll at The Examiner looking at one angle of it. But if you ask people about abortion laws, for example, third trimester abortion, or if you ask them about the constitutional arrangement, should states be allowed to regulate it or should the courts basically shut down almost every state regulation of it, then you get a much more mixed opinion. On the constitutional question, it's mixed. Late-term abortions, the public overwhelmingly thinks there should be restrictions and or bans on late-term abortions. That's a really tough thing to explain. I spend a lot of my 20 years writing about Roe and about how even judicial scholars who are pro-choice say that it was actually a really bad ruling. But the surface question, when people are asked about Roe v. Wade, however the public interprets it, they think they like it. They think that if Roe were overturned, all abortion would be outlawed. And that's a minority opinion, that all abortion should be outlawed. So that's why Republicans are running away from it, because they don't have the ability to fight this nuanced fight over abortion law, states, courts, late-term, early abortion.
Christina, I think that Democrats also run into a messaging issue here, which is to say, we talk so much about the binary of would Roe be overturned or not, but Roe has already been narrowed by previous decisions from the court, including the Casey decision in 1992 that gave states more room to regulate abortions. And it's conceivable that a court could significantly further narrow the right to abortion without officially overturning Roe. And I don't know that Democrats have fully explained the policy stakes of that, because a state regulating abortion can mean a lot of different things. And some of the proposals, some states that, for example, have sought to prohibit abortion after the 20th week of pregnancy, there's a lot of public support for that in polling. But then you look at other things states have done that act as are tantamount to prohibitions on abortion in the state. You do things where you require certifications that are going to be impossible to obtain, hospital admitting privileges in places where no hospital is going to give those privileges to a doctor who performs abortions. And so the regulation really ends up looking like one of those unpopular prohibitions on abortion that Tim points out. So what is the way to talk about the specific stakes before the court and the things that people might be okay with states being allowed to do and the things that people would not be okay with?
Right. I mean, I have to agree with Tim here on the Democratic side as well. We, you know, have moved to easy slogans: keep Roe, overturn Roe, one or the other, all abortions or no abortions. And none of those is actually correct or even plausible at this moment, but yet they're so much easier to campaign on and talk about that that's what we're left with. I actually think that the Democratic Party, by focusing so much on overturning Roe and not overturning Roe, and just abortion, period, with no nuance, or no abortion at all, period, has done itself and, frankly, the United States a disservice. Because as Tim was saying, and as you know, I have also seen and written about, if you do look at the polls, the majority of Americans are in favor of abortion being available at certain points in a pregnancy, but there's still actually a lot of, you know, confusion, mixed feelings, individual discussion that needs to be had as to what regulations are seen as fair, how late in a pregnancy, what that should look like. Most women, in fact, are, you know, do have some mixed feelings about abortion. And, you know, forcing everyone to take a side, you're either pro-abortion, at will all the time, or you're anti-abortion and therefore you hate women, is a disservice to the real dialogue that we should be having, including the best ways to support women who might need to get an abortion or want to get an abortion because they lack the resources to care for a child, but who, with a better government, with better welfare systems and a social safety net, might actually have the resources to keep a child that they would otherwise want. That should be, I think, more of a priority for both parties than just fighting over Roe and not Roe without any explanation. And yet we don't seem to have gotten there yet.
One thing that Tim said is that it's unfortunate the level of power that the court has here. And partly the court inherently has quite a lot of power through its ability to conduct judicial review and strike down laws. But I think the court has been strengthened over the last few decades by a certain level of atrophy in the legislative process. Because the legislature, because Congress does not act, then it's left to the court to make policy. And it seems to me that that would not necessarily have to be the case. And so we will have, quite possibly after this election, a federal government that is under control of Democrats, both the Congress and the White House. And that, I think, can do something to reduce the stakes at the Supreme Court. And so, Tim, I want to ask you about this first, because there was a Supreme Court decision in 2007 called Gonzales v. Carhart that upheld the federal prohibition on certain kinds of late-term abortion procedures. And the court said that Congress had the power to make this law under its power to regulate interstate commerce. So does that mean that if Roe were struck down, couldn't a Democratic Congress impose a federal law that restricted the ability of states to regulate abortions in certain ways?
If Roe is struck down, for the most part, things would go to the states. But the Carhart logic involving interstate commerce could be used. You're right there. But what I expect would happen is that the issue would largely be left to the states. And that's because it might be that we have a federal law that draws the wide boundaries that we talk about. Most people think that aborting a viable fetus is not acceptable and should be illegal. And most people think that an abortion when you get your pregnancy test and a couple weeks later at 12, 11 weeks gestation should be legal, even if they don't approve of that morally. And if the federal government drew those boundaries and then states drew boundaries in between is what I think is the most likely thing. And if the court ended up sort of endorsing that, I would not be surprised. Again, overturning Roe is not flipping off a light switch. It might be saying, look, the states absolutely have a right to protect viable fetuses or to prevent discrimination or to put actual safety measures on abortionists or ask for parental notification.
Yeah, Christine, this gets to the conversation that we've been having about court packing and the question of, will Democrats respond to Barrett's confirmation by adding more justices to the court? And it seems to me that if Democrats win this election and therefore have the power to pack the court, they'll also have the power to protect certain abortion rights through federal legislation. They'll also have the power to change the Affordable Care Act so that the statutory challenges against it, including the one that's working the way through the courts right now, those challenges would no longer have any chance of success because they would essentially fix the aspects of the law that put it in any level of vulnerability in the courts. So I'm wondering, do Democrats really need more seats on the judiciary, or do they have the ability to fix a lot of these concerns that they have through legislation?
Yeah, well, we'll see. I think the ability to fix things through legislation right now would depend on Democrats having a majority in the houses of legislation, which they don't currently have. And if the election, tended strongly towards Democrats, if there was a blue wave and Democrats suddenly, overtook a majority in the Senate and the House, then they probably could pass some of this federal legislation and the courts, might be okay. Joe Biden himself has said that when he does agree to talk about it at all, it's true that he has been avoiding the question, is not in favor of court packing. Other Democrats, though, are strongly in favor. And I think that the reason for that is that, legislation can be passed in one administration and overturned by the next. However, for now, unfortunately, not because I want any justices to die or leave, but because I actually think that there should be term limits on the Supreme Court right now, a conservative majority will stay a conservative majority for perhaps decades, whereas Democratic passed or Republican passed legislation may come or go. I think that having the security of a liberal Supreme Court is what Democrats are after when they talk about court packing. That said, you know, maybe if they are able to pass legislation and that legislation is shown to have, you know, broad and widespread American support, then a Supreme Court that, you know, perhaps represents the people and makes decisions with, you know, the public concern and consent in mind might then uphold such legislation and wouldn't be as fearful a prospect. But judging from how ideological, you know, some of the remaining justices are, and as Amy Coney Barrett seems like she would be on the court, Democrats do have some reason to fear that that won't be the case.
Let's take a break. I've been talking with Christine Emba of The Washington Post and Tim Carney of The Washington Examiner. We'll be back with Dr. Lauren Ansel Myers of the University of Texas to talk about the spread of the coronavirus. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Tim Carney, columnist at The Washington Examiner. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. Across the country, there's a patchwork of policies about education during the coronavirus pandemic. About half the nation's school districts were intending to return to full in-person instruction as of August, but choices about how to do education appear to be driven not just by population density and coronavirus conditions, but also political differences, with more Democratic jurisdictions more likely to be engaged in more remote learning, even where infection rates are low. One consequence of that is that low-income and minority students are significantly less likely than average to be learning in person. These choices about schools are part of a broader struggle that policymakers, organizations, and people are facing all over the country. What can we do right now and what can't we? What can go back to normal? What are the activities that really will spread a lot of virus? To help us work through those questions, Dr. Lauren Ansel Myers joins us now. Dr. Myers is an epidemiologist and professor of biology at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the director of the UT COVID-19 Modeling Consortium. Hello, Dr. Myers.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
So broadly, what is open right now that should be closed and what's closed that we could be reopening?
I think it's a, you know, very location specific decision. And there's three types of risks that really have to be considered when deciding if, when to open, how many kids and staff to bring on campus. The first, and you just mentioned this, is, you know, what's going on with COVID in the community? Is it spreading widely? Is the prevalence high or is it low? And that really governs the chance that one or more kids or teachers will show up infected when they do start coming back to campus. So that's the first part. But then, you know, the second part is, what can the schools do to ensure that if somebody does show up, that they won't spread the virus to others? And that takes resources and planning and capacity. And then the final risk to think about is, what are the chances that if the virus does spread on campus, that it'll spill over, that students or teachers will take it home and spread the virus to other members of their household or their community? And so, you know, in thinking about whether schools are opening prematurely or they could be opening but haven't yet, you really have to kind of think on all these different scales and evaluate what kinds of resources are available and in place to mitigate those risks.
And what do you see around the country in terms of how well those decisions are being made, both whether school districts and other organizations that are involved here, whether they're making the right choices to bring themselves to a position where they can safely open, and then whether they're making the right decisions about whether or not to open, given the situation that they're in?
It's hard to know, you know, what's happening on a local scale. I'm only talking directly to a handful of schools, but the schools I have been talking to are mostly erring on the side of caution. They are looking at all these risks and taking sort of baby steps towards bringing students and teachers safely to campus. It is possible that some could be moving faster and doing it in a safe way, but I have always encouraged schools that I've spoken to test the waters, to ensure that things are working well before they bring too many people to campus at once.
Tim, I know this has been a major area of political controversy in Maryland, where you live.
That's right. They closed the public schools in most of the school districts near D.C. and throughout a lot of Maryland. And then our county actually tried to close all the private schools. And we fought back, and with the help of Governor Larry Hogan, we were able to keep them open. But a lot of the private schools didn't want to open. And the only ones that did were the ones who thought they could put in proper measures. And Lauren, I'm sure you know about these sort of things, but I think most listeners don't realize that if you're in school, if you're a first grader or a 12th grader or whatever, in a lot of America, you're wearing a mask all day, except for maybe when you step outside and when you eat, that there's an upwards stairwell and a downwards stairwell. They have lane markers on the hallway, and recess basically doesn't allow touching or wrestling or horsing around or anything like that. And there's more, you know, chemicals used to disinfect the school than you've ever seen in any of these schools before. And so all these efforts happening on the private schools, I'm hoping, are paving a way, as you're saying, like it's showing here's how to do it well. And what we haven't seen spread within school in our local private schools, in K through 12 public schools, obviously we had that early outbreak that got social media with those crowded hallways. What are we seeing there? Are there places where there's big spread in K through 12 schools? Are there best practices we can now say every school should do this sort of thing?
As you suggest, we're sort of learning as we go, right? We've never been through a pandemic. School administrators were never trained on how to safely operate schools during a pandemic. And so, you know, we're all sort of scrambling and looking to other parts of the world, looking across the United States to see what's working and what's not. And there's some basic principles that seem prudent and things that you just mentioned, including, you know, face masking, even the youngest kids, encouraging them to keep physical distance. You know, one of the highest risk activities that probably happens in schools these days is when kids eat lunch together. Right? When they take off their masks, it's a time when respiratory particles can leave their mouths and get into the air. And so, you know, ensuring that when kids do eat, they eat at a distance, they eat in well-ventilated or even outdoor environments. And so, so face masks, being safe when eating, physical distance, you know, all those things certainly are prudent at this point. Whether they're the reason for the success, we don't know, but they seem to help. And then as, you know, really importantly, as testing becomes more economical, becomes more widely available, that is going to be really a key mitigation resource to allow people to come onto campuses, to go into workplaces, providing sort of a gateway to both keep virus out of these kinds of communities and also ensure that if virus does start spreading in a school, we identify those clusters and take action as early as possible.
Christine, when the president criticizes some of the coronavirus response from creating large problems, even as it tries to mitigate them, you know, in general, I think he has the wrong side of that argument. But I think the strongest case is the significant loss of learning that we have had in K-12, where online learning is just not working as well as in-person learning, and especially for students who face challenges at home in low-income households or who may not have the same technological setups that people in higher income households have. I think there's a real and large cost there. And I'm just wondering, that that doesn't mean that we should just throw open every school as normal. We can't do that. But I don't know about the extent to which policymakers have actually grasped with that significant cost that they're imposing on children all over the country as we take measures to stop the spread.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. I think that that's one thing that we don't have, you know, as much real-time evidence, say, as we do about the spread of COVID-19. And so policymakers and some scientists, I guess, find that loss harder to judge. And so perhaps don't weigh it as strongly as they should. But I absolutely agree. I really do wonder and worry about what we'll see, you know, when this pandemic has died down and kids go back to school and there are significant deficits that some kids have experienced while others have, you know, scooted on ahead. I also have thought that, you know, Donald Trump's and many others' approach to this, that we have to keep schools closed no matter what the cost. Actually, no, I will say that the president did not say that. He wanted everyone to get back to normal yesterday, is kind of at odds with what Trump did say he wanted, which is for, you know, the economy to get back on its feet, for people to get back out there. If schools are closed, schools are childcare. People who have to watch their kids, teach their kids at home, even just watch them be on Zoom with a teacher who isn't paying attention, cannot also work at the same time. So there's a cost for children, yes, but there is a huge cost for their parents and for the economy that they're no longer participating in.
Dr. Myers, the environment in which schools decide whether to reopen or not, it's not just about the mitigation measures that those schools have and are able to take themselves. It's about the situation in the broader community. Are there things that we should be looking at, things that if we got better in the broader community, then more schools would be in an epidemiological position where they would be ready to open?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, one way to sort of ballpark the risk that students or teachers will show up infected in the schools is to look at the recent case reports from your own community, from your own county. And in fact, we've built risk maps that have appeared in the New York Times, and we're about to launch a dashboard on our own website that allows somebody to look at their county and ballpark, you know, what's the chance if I have a school with 500 kids in it, for example, that one or more students will show up next week. And so I think, you know, and the general message is the higher the prevalence in the community, the more likely it is that people will get infected outside of school and arrive at school infected. And, you know, that's because this is such a stealthy virus, right? People are, now we know that people are contagious and in fact, highly contagious sometimes before they ever have symptoms. And some people never even develop symptoms. So, you know, it's not about bad behavior or not having the right precautions in place. It's just that people just simply don't know that they're infected. And so, so again, yeah, looking at what is the background prevalence. And so in order to make it safer for schools to open, we need to be taking steps to reduce the prevalence, reduce transmission in the community as a whole. And, you know, we're, as with schools, you know, we're sort of learning as we go. What are things that we can do to reduce transmission to community that don't exact, you know, enormous societal and economic costs? And so there's sort of similar messages. You know, people should wear face masks. They should keep physical distance when in public. They should try to, when they do meet in well-ventilated places, meet outside. Employers should do and communities should do things to incentivize people to stay home from work if they or any member of their household has a symptom. And so it's, you know, these measures that we're sort of learning that we've seen have had a real impact in reducing transmission, you know, early in the spring, and then helped some of the Sunbelt states bring their summer surges under control. So we just need to continue those kinds of efforts, you know, as in terms of both policy and individual decision making on a daily basis.
Dr. Lauren Ansel Myers is an epidemiologist and professor of biology at the University of Texas at Austin and director of the UT COVID-19 Modeling Consortium. Dr. Myers, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Tim Carney, what's your rant?
Steve Scully, the C-SPAN guy, was supposed to be the most plain vanilla guy in all of media. I've met him. He had no opinions, right? He was the safest guy in a media environment populated by celebrities. And he got suspended from C-SPAN for lying about his messaging with Anthony Scaramucci. And it's another example of the plague of our loss of authority figures here in the United States as politics takes over the type of people who we're just supposed to be able to rely on. The Surgeon General, his supposedly noble lie about masks back in the spring undermined his authority. But don't start to think this is a Trump thing. The WHO, the World Health Organization, said that travel bans weren't helpful. That, it turns out, was based on politics. Lancet, the famed medical journal, published a study on hydroxychloroquine that didn't meet their standards, but it seemed to be published because it dinged Donald Trump. You had public health experts saying, oh, well, Black Lives Matter's protests are more important than the risk of spread. And then outside of the health thing, you had the New York Times self-editing its 1619 project, Twitter, supposedly a new neutral platform, botching these stories about Joe Biden, and even our dictionary becoming the wingman for Democrats trying to take down Amy Coney Barrett. I used to be a guy who said we didn't need all these authorities. Now I realize we need them, and it's just a shame to watch them lighting their credibility on fire for political points.
Christine Embo, what's on your mind?
So I've been thinking this week as we've been watching these Amy Coney Barrett hearings about the, at best, confused and at worst, and probably truthfully cynical, misunderstanding that conservatives seem to have about feminism, what it is and what it means. So we're hearing a lot of dialogue around Amy Coney Barrett. You know, she's the new Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Trump nominated a woman. She's female, so sexism isn't a thing anymore, and everybody should be lining up to support her. That's not how feminism works. We don't have to support all groundbreaking women just because they're women. So yes, Amy Barrett has 7 children, which is great for her. You know, I appreciate that she shows that it's possible to combine motherhood, but what is she doing to help other women have that same opportunity? Yes, she's female and she's achieved things, but her rulings against environmental protections, consumer protections, her history on immigration, healthcare, and sexual assault show that she's not actually planning to advocate for the vulnerable in other places, or women, in fact. Yes, feminism is still important because not enough women get a seat at the table, and we should be glad when more do. But just because a woman has a seat at the table doesn't mean that she's working for other women to have one too. Amy Coney Barrett might be female, but that doesn't make her a feminist, and that doesn't mean that I have to support her.
For my rant, Black Friday sales have kept getting earlier in recent years. Black Friday is the day after Thanksgiving, but stores started opening on Thanksgiving, so people can start their sale shopping right after they finish their turkey, or maybe even before. Then Black Friday sales started starting early in November. But this year, Black Friday starts in October. Retailers are adjusting to the coronavirus by encouraging people to shop for Christmas early, really early. They don't want people crowding into stores all at once. There will be no doorbusters this year. And many retailers have announced that they will close again on Thanksgiving. Very little that has happened because of the pandemic is good, but there have been a few positive developments that have arisen that I hope we can keep. And I am hoping the return of Thanksgiving for leisure instead of shopping is one of them. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Christine Emba, Tim Carney, and Lauren Ansel Myers. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Our production fellow is Victoria Alejandro. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.